I get that a lot.
Hello and welcome to episode 166 of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other lawless scumbags as masterpieces. I am Nick, the ineffectual president of this podcast, and I am joined as ever by Roger.
Manly grunt.
And we can't resist the allure of the carpenter. We are returning back on our slowly progressive exploration of John Carpenter's oeuvre.
Well, also, if you're listening to these in order, after last time, we wanted a film that we were pretty sure we would actually and honestly enjoy.
Yeah, that's true. Let's not talk about last episode. And instead, delve into Escape from New York, John Carpenter's third feature, I think, fourth?
Something like that.
We had Dark Star, then Halloween, and
there's Precinct 13 as well.
He gets around a bit, doesn't he? All of which, well, we haven't talked about Dark Star, actually. We possibly will.
We're bound to eventually.
Yeah. But this time, we are in the 1981 possible masterpiece, where the entirety of New York, or the entirety of Manhattan, I should say, has been turned into a prison for ne'er-do-wells and scumbags. It is set in the distant future of 1997, when things seemed dystopian. Never mind. I've depressed myself by thinking about, about the actual dystopian future we're living in. Never mind. Here we go. We have several returning alumni. We have Kurt Russell, of course. Ernest Borgnine, who we spoke about in Marty.
I think by this point he has settled into what was really his standard for the career, which I guess is a specialisation of character actor. You know, he is usually the gruff, heart of gold, crusty, friendly, not the romantic hero.
Not anymore, no, but it was nice to see him in Marty. As well as, Donald Pleasance, we have a bit of Isaac Hayes, Adrienne Barbeau, the frequent collaborator and collaborative person with John Carpenter and one-time wife, I think. Mm. Anyway, the story is that in the distant future of 1997, China and Russia, I think, are at war with America somehow, or close to war, or it's very tense. Things are going badly. There is a big peace conference about to happen, but terrorists hijack Air Force One and crash it into the horrible, isolated prison of Manhattan, which has basically been walled off and everyone in there is left to themselves.
Yeah, which is a fairly standard dystopian or semi-dystopian fictional trope.
Yes, I once ran a Strontium Dog game where my instinct was to wall off the entirety of Cornwall and make it a prison, but I didn't quite go that far. I should have done. That would have been very Strontium
Dog. You leave out the bit at the edge where they'll sell you tourist tat and tell you to go home. Yeah, so, I mean, this is very 70s, 80s thinking, you know, gang violence is just getting worse. Nothing can possibly be done about this. We are just going to have to abandon the cities.
Abandon the city, seal them up, and leave them to it.
Oh, one can't help feeling that, you know, Manhattan Island is very expensive.
And that's a lot of real estate there.
And given some of the stuff that does get done by the government in this film, one feels that, you know, nerve-gassing the entire place and then rebuilding would probably be cheaper. But anyway.
It doesn't make a lot of sense, to be honest.
There were two basic inspirations of this script. One is the whole Watergate thing.
And the kind of disillusionment with the president and the office of the president and cynicism.
Yeah, Americans, in my experience, are a little strange about this because they have this, you know, there is this respect for the office and there is respect for the guy, and they often seem to get conflated, which, I don't know.
Yes.
But anyway, that is definitely on the downslope here.
Don't get me depressed about the
other inspiration that Carpenter acknowledged, at least, is Death Wish, Charles Bronson's big breakout.
Well, I guess is that like the urban grittiness of it all? Is that the idea?
They killed his wife, raped his daughter, whatever it is. I can't remember exactly.
It's one of those revenge films.
They got his women, so he's going to get revenge.
Yes, yeah. The only revenge film I enjoyed was Chef, where he gets the villains and then cooks them a meal.
Pig.
Pig. Sorry, not Chef. Thank you.
So that's where this is coming from. This film won me over at a specific moment. Which was, they're talking to the plane. They're trying to get in touch with the plane. They're realizing it's doing something unusual that they haven't actually been made aware of, where it's been hijacked yet.
This is Air Force One.
Yeah. Well, yes. They don't even know that yet.
No, they just know it's call signed.
But the controller says, Squawk 7700, contact on 121.5. Now, A, that is the right thing to do. You tell them to squawk the distress code, because that will light up every air traffic controller's board with a highlight on this aircraft. And you say, contact on the stat, you can't contact us here on this frequency, but in case you're listening, contact us on this other frequency, which is the standard. Everybody should be listening out on this as well as what they're actually talking on. And right. It's the right number and the right frequency. We've had a lot
you
of films.
You like in, a bit of
yes, all right, this is Roger's Aviation Corner, but we've had a lot of films, not just from aviation, where there is some technical thing happening, and the filmmakers have just said, it's probably a bit like this.
Somebody
in that script writing team said, let's find out if there's actually a procedure for this, an actual thing somebody could say, I'll take an air traffic controller out to the bar and buy him a few drinks. That's all the research it needs, but they got it right.
Very similitude, isn't it? I guess we've all got different levels of where it worked for us, but it won you over with the detail. It works, though. One of our favourite films was Death Boat, and that's because it gets all the technical details right and still has drama and interest. You don't need to fudge the detail. One of our least favourite films, well, maybe that's a bit much, but Argo we didn't like because it got almost everything wrong just for the sake of drama. So, I'm all for a bit of verisimilitude.
The nice thing about it is, it doesn't need to break the story, as we see here.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, it's just a little incidental detail.
Nobody has to have a long lecture about how this is the distress code that you use, as I've just given. All right, sorry. But the point is, as an audience member, you can just say, he's saying something terribly manly and air traffic control-ish, and you can appreciate it on that level. It doesn't break it.
As it works for you, you know a bit about that subject, and it works for you. That means you trust the film, to get other things that you don't know so much about correct as well. So
this is possibly a failure in me. Good heavens, I guess I'm a film critic. I'm not a real one, obviously, but I guess that's what I'm doing.
What are a real film?
But I do find quite often that there can be a little bit early in a film, which either makes me feel positive about it the way I did with this, or makes me feel negative about it because it's, we're trying to show the hero is a tough guy and he does something completely cruel and pointless, but we're still supposed to cheer for him, that kind of thing.
And it's very hard to get over that first impression, isn't it?
Well, it can just set my mood for the rest of the film.
Well, sometimes, I think it worked for you in The Howling, where the whole porn theatre scene soured you on the rest of the film quickly. Sometimes I find the only way I get over those first impressions is our little discussions here, actually. So it's helpful to have them. Anyway, the Air Force One is hijacked and flown into, thankfully not the Twin Towers, which is still standing in this film, but they are flown into a building. It is flown into a building. They have this very peculiar looking escape pod in Air Force One. I don't suppose that's a real thing in Air Force One, is it?
I think this is where it was invented. There is, I think it's a Wesley Snipes film that has something similar.
Right.
I can't remember and I haven't seen it. Many people appear to believe that this is a thing because obviously it's a thing you would do. But if you consider for a moment a parachute.
Yes.
You need a lot of parachute to land even a single soldier with kit. Never mind a great big escape pod with lots of armour and things.
Mm.
And basically this would become the major part of the cargo of the aircraft.
And they're not very high when he ejects.
Also, parachutists need skill, and this has to work completely autonomously.
We'll hand wave you over. So there we go. We go straight from something realistic, something not that realistic.
Let's come halfway back because there's a hybrid here. We don't get a good look at the Air Force One in this. I found a picture of the contemporary 707 that would have been their visual inspiration. That, I mean, it's 1997, maybe this wouldn't be the same thing, but that was what there was at the time. They've done a reasonable duplicate of the livery. It's clearly not the same aircraft, but that's fair enough. The interesting thing is they hybridized it. Because the 707 is your classic engines under the wings airliner.
Right.
This one has engines on the tail. And it,
well,
it's actually the
that's
tail.
That's the way the Saudis designed it for them.
Well, it doesn't make a huge difference to performance. There are various reasons. But it's actually the tail off a Convair. And I have a strong suspicion that the reason for this is that they had a wrecked Convair.
I was going to say, they could find the wrecked. Yes,
so when you see the tail of the engines there, yeah, that's the same plane.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Donald Pleasance is the president, and he is dropped into this pit of thieves and murderers, and there is only one guy.
Strangely, does not end up in charge.
Well, that would be the really cynical way of writing. Actually, that's a really good idea. Snake Plissken, on the other hand, has committed some crime for which we don't know. He never denies it. We never find out what it is.
He robbed a major gold vault or something of that nature.
That's it. And this is Kurt Russell, complete with eye patch and manly grunt. I mean, Kurt Russell has got some range. He was fresh off some kind of Disney comedies when he was doing this. So he's not always the manly tough guy. But here he is.
I mean, we've seen him in The Thing. But we've also seen him in Big Trouble from Little China, so.
Which, in Big Trouble in Little China, he's basically taking the piss out of Snake Plissken in a way.
Yeah.
In that he's a guy who thinks he's Snake Plissken, but is not the main character and doesn't realise it. Which I do appreciate. But here he is, the real deal, the genuine grunty alpha male, who is recruited by Lee Van Cleef.
Another face I love to see.
Yeah, he's good here. I think he's the chief of police or someone high up in
chief
the federal.
Of police, which basically means the guy in charge of the prison and everything around it.
And they seem to have pretty much carte blanche to do anything they like with these prisoners, including so Snake has already agreed to do this mission. The mission is to go in and get the president. There is a time limit because if this summit finishes in the next 22 hours or something like that, then the president hasn't come back with a tape, which is the gift of nuclear fusion to the world as a peace offering. I don't know how well that would work, but there you go. If you can
well, give. Also, you know, this is presumably there is another copy of the information where they got it from.
I would hope so.
Unless he came up with it on the flight.
But it seems very important. He has the tape of it. He has the MacGuffin tape. If he doesn't get the tape back in these hours, the world may or may not end, or the war may occur, but bad things will happen.
But he won't mind because they've also stuck a time release toxin into him.
It's explosives that will blow apart his carotid arteries, which seems a bit dramatic. But there we go. His head's going to blow off. It was at this sort of point when they're setting up this mission that I realised, I haven't seen this film, but I realised what an influence Escape from New York has had on my little corner of the world, by which I mean nerdy role-playing hobbyists.
Absolutely.
I mean, the whole setup just felt like a ton of board games and role-playing games and comics and things from that era that I grew up with, particularly like Games Workshop, kind of, Chainsaw Warrior, the board game, is basically this film. But there's lots of characters that I have met and encountered that are basically Snake Plissken, or
Absolutely.
Characters from the
film. Everybody is his bastard son. I mean, that's entirely plausible for the character, in fact. So. But yeah, so many tough guy characters that, you know, I played with people in the 80s, in the 90s, didn't know because I only saw this film the first time recently for this. But yeah, very much influenced by, and I can absolutely see why.
Well, that's what you talk about when you sort of started to feel warmly to the film. To me, it felt, I've never seen it before, but it felt weirdly like coming home a bit because it just felt very familiar sort of tropes and feeling. Not in a dated way, but just in a way that, oh yeah, okay, this is where all this came from. It's not quite cyberpunk. I guess it's like urban decay warfare kind of, in a way that some, like Running Man tried to do, but didn't really. Running Man was later than this, I think.
Quite a lot,
yes, definitely. But this just gets this kind of sense of urban crime horror, which is not quite what cyberpunk is, but it felt very familiar.
I think it's foundational in the way that Aliens is to military SF films. Even if you're not copying it, you're aware of it and you're deliberately moving away from it.
Yes, I think that's fair. So Snake has to go into Manhattan. And the way he's going to do it, they've mined the bridges and they patrol the rivers with helicopters. So, but presumably they're not going to shoot him down. He is going to fly in a glider, which again, I may hand back to Roger's Aviation Corner.
Well, the actual glider is an actual glider.
Right.
The instrument panel is complete nonsense.
Is that too heavy for a glider then?
No, it's just that there are no actual flight instruments involved.
Literally just a shell that flies through the sky.
Let me clarify. The glider that we see from the outside is a perfectly good real glider.
Yes.
The instrument panel that we only see in close-up is complete nonsense.
Right, okay. There is no such thing in that glider.
Or any aircraft.
Okay. Well, it's the future. He's got a future.
Yeah, but I still want to know how high you are and how fast you're going and stuff like that. As opposed to these really neat 3D wireframe renderings. Do you know how they did those?
I guess, because I've seen similar things in a similar film. What they did was actually film everything in the dark with like reflective tape and flying through the air. I think I've seen similar things done in other films, but it works really well.
Specifically UV light, and they just taped up their existing model of the city with the UV fluorescent tape.
And flew something through. It works. It does look very computery. I think maybe Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy did something. I'm glad my knowledge of special effects has come to the fore. And he lands on top of the Twin Towers, which does date the film a little bit, but it is set in 1997. They have survived this dystopian future.
I personally would not
future.
Have painted a military stealth glider bright white, but hey, what do I know?
So he lands on the highest point in New York, and then it's not the best landing. He lands very close to the edge of the Twin Towers. It's a nice bit. I like where he fires out there. It's like an anchor and he has to stop. And it's, I like that it's not a perfect landing. He obviously failed his piloting role for that bit. I don't know. I was in full, I'm enjoying this in a role playing sense mode. I have to say, as far as, you know, you talked about sympathetic characters before, we don't have a lot in this film. It has to be said, you know, he's one of those characters that is going to survive minute to minute, and that's how he exists. So he's interesting to see how he does that, but I think it's hard to call him a sympathetic character. The people who sent him on the mission are even bigger assholes. The president's obviously an asshole. Everyone in Manhattan is pretty much an asshole.
So some of the people in Manhattan are trying to make a better life for others as well as themselves.
Yes. I was going to say Harry Dean Stanton's character, but that's not true. He's also an asshole. But Adrian Barbeau is the closest thing we have to a sympathetic character, I think. But it's not, I feel warmly to the setting. So, it pulled me along regardless. Kurt Russell is a charismatic, guy. And
well, that's the thing. He does that good acting job of, yes, all right, I can see perfectly well that there is no real character here beyond I am competent, I am tough, I am vaguely pleasant when it doesn't cost me anything.
Mm.
But he carries you through, and he at least for me, he gets me into sympathy with him without even really doing anything.
You want him to succeed. Yeah. Well, you want him to survive in a way, and you understand he doesn't even really want to succeed particularly. He's just trying to get through. So he descends to floor 50 of whichever of the Twin Towers it is, in an elevator, and then has to walk the rest of the way into the grimy hellscape of New York.
Because this is their method for not letting the locals realise that there is still power up there.
Yes.
As we find out, this completely fails, but yeah.
they know, or they don't care. Anyway, he then descends to the city streets and finds, I quite like that, then we find this kind of, I think it was nicely done, that it is just a bit crazy in the way that, you know, society is slightly broken. Well, it's a lot broken down, but there are structures, you know, there's clearly some entertainment laid on, and the entertainment is very, well, it's kind of a cross between burlesque and lunatic. It's kind of a drag show, but also undercurrent of violence. I like the kind of vibe of this. It felt a bit like Mega City 1 to me in the Judge Dredd comics, that it's just nuts, but there was a structure to it that made sense. It wasn't just complete anarchy.
And you know, it could easily have been just, well, everybody out here is just out to kill everybody they can, or get whatever they can, etc. And well, yes, but not just in the immediate physical sense.
Yes, yeah, they're trying to build something.
Even if it's just, I'm going to keep my people safe from the other crazies.
Yes, exactly. So he has a tracking device on his wrist. Is it on his wrist? Somewhere. Yes, it is on his wrist. And he tracks down the president's motion watch thing. But unfortunately, that's being worn by a lunatic man in the depths of New York. And he has to abandon that plan.
Also, I'd just like to say that what I'm seeing here, the same thing we saw in Assault on Precinct 13, which is, this is a setting which is diegetically very dark.
Yes.
And yet it is always shot so that you can see what's going on.
Do you know, I hadn't even thought of that, but you're right. It's because it just didn't occur to me. We complained quite a bit on Ribbon of Memes about kind of muddy actions. There's only one film we've kind of forgiven it with, and that's Platoon, because the whole point of the action scene was to be, what the fuck is happening? I don't understand.
Yeah.
But in most other films, I want to, as a viewer, be able to follow the action. And so often, you just can't, and I'm just waiting for it to be over so I can now work out what has happened in the meantime. Hmm. That, you're right, never once did that happen to me in Escape from New York. I was about to say Assault from Precinct 13. It didn't happen in Assault from Precinct 13 either. We were very pleased with the kind of framing of the action there, I think, and got a good sense of place, which we didn't very... We were complaining about it last, as I recall, in Dog Soldiers, where it just didn't quite get a good sense of place in the barn.
The subset of that I'm getting at specifically here is there are obviously many good reasons to shoot dark.
Yes.
Like, you can't afford to dress the sets more than the basics.
Yes.
There are bits of this which do betray... You know, it's not that it looks bad, it's that they are doing the things to avoid showing the things that would look bad. Like, for example, a higher budget film would give you a shot of Kurt Russell in the cockpit of the glider while it's flying.
Yes.
We do not get that. We get cutaways. That sort of thing.
You don't miss it. Yeah, you're right. You're right. I'm terrible at noticing this sort of thing.
I got slightly less of that sort of thing when I watched a lot of cheap film in quick succession. Back when I had a local video shop which had some very cheap bad film.
And we should make, like, this is a very low budget film. Carpenter was, I think it was just after Halloween, so he had some clout because that had done very well. But it was still, like, this is not filmed in New York, is it? It's filmed in some...
They filmed it, I can't remember where it was. There was a particular city for which a whole neighbourhood had a really huge fire. And the city, being quite poor, hadn't really started rebuilding.
So it looked like an absolute hellscape. Which is, yes.
Because it was, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, because it was. Yeah, so, as you say, it's very dark, but you never don't know what's going on. What I like here is that Snake is, I am not a Snake Plissken, but he kind of does what a person would do in this sort of, like, he goes to find the what, it's not there, so he's like, okay, well, I'll go back and look at the wreckage of the plane then, which is what he does next. And tries to work out exactly what's happening. I had missed out a bit of the plot, which is where Lee Van Cleef and a ton of policemen go to get the president back. This is why they need Snake. They go to get the president back only to find he's been captured by the head honcho of the New York. For some reason, I can't think of anyone but the Overdog, which is a character Michael Ironside played in
The Duke.
The Duke, thank you very much. Played by Isaac Hayes, who more recently has played the chef in South Park.
We have actually seen him in movies before, though only just because he was the default black guy in Robin Hood Men in Tights.
Okay.
Obviously much better known for writing Soul Man and Theme from Shaft and other...
Yes, exactly. He's primarily a musician.
Songs,
but very good here. Anyway, he has the president, and he says that they'll kill him if they come any closer. So Snake's got to go in and get him stealthily, which is semi-successful at.
So this was mostly filmed in St. Louis, because East St. Louis had a whole lot of fire in 76.
And haven't rebuilt by 81.
Yeah.
Gosh. Okay.
They did actually film a little bit in New York. They got permission to film on the actual Liberty Island.
That's the bit with Van Cleef, isn't it?
And those, yeah, those so you're looking up at the statue.
Yeah.
And obviously, okay. A prison headquarters on Liberty Island. We're not being subtle here.
We should say this film was written by Carpenter. He's a multi-talented, so it was written by Carpenter. It was scored by Carpenter. Mm-hmm. It has a very classic Carpenter kind of electronic theme, which, I mean, we always like, well, for the most part, we like John Carpenter's music. Usually, it's particularly suitable for this kind of dark film.
On the one hand, there's nothing that stuck with me like the opening of Assault on Precinct 13.
Yeah, that stands out to me as the best. And
on the other hand, its job is to give an impression at the time more than to stick with you. So, should say co-written by frequent collaborator Nick Castle.
Who was Mike Myers, I think, in Halloween, possibly. I don't know where that trivia came from, but I think he was Mike Myers. Listeners can check that if they are interested, or if it makes any difference to your lives. Snake then goes to has he already done this already? He goes to an old coffee shop and meets who appears to be the female lead. She looks strikingly like Jamie Lee Curtis, but isn't Jamie Lee Curtis.
First he meets Ernest Bouldin.
Oh, yes, he meets Ernest Bouldin. The well-natured cabbie, who is a fan of Snake.
Yeah, but also this is where the real dissonance is happening, because, you know, Snake is all these prime day people are leaping out from shadows and trying to eat him. Yes. And here is this guy who just seems to be a cabbie.
Yes, he is one of the nice characters in the film. He gets treated very badly by Snake, to be fair. He is one of the many people who's heard of Snake and assumes he's dead. I like the fact that we never know why anyone thinks Snake is dead, but everyone always thinks Snake is dead whenever they meet him, and it becomes a bit of a running joke.
Mm-hmm. So he moves on, and then we have the coffee shop scene. Now, this coffee shop scene may feel to you completely disposable, and there's a reason for that, but we'll come back to that.
Okay, it did feel a bit disposable.
It doesn't really advance the plot, and he hides in the coffee shop because there are them out there.
Yes, these are the kind of zombie-alike. So these are the weird ones that live in the basement.
He meets a woman who has clearly been surviving here for a while, who is also hiding there.
I really thought that was Jamie Lee Curtis for a minute, but it wasn't. It isn't, and it doesn't matter because she's not in the film for terribly long.
But you know, they have a quick bit of dialogue. Then the bad guys come in through the back wall or floor or possibly both. Beat her. He gets away. I think he loses very bits of equipment along the way because, you know, the classic hero going through on his own resources thing.
Yes, yeah. She gets pulled through the ground, Ella Hudson in Aliens, as I recall.
And now my working theory, which is possibly not a very polite theory, but, you know, I'm not saying there was any corruption here, but I think not so much the reason she got the part, but the reason this scene was written in is that she was at the time Kurt Russell's wife.
Oh, interesting.
I'm not saying this was a bad thing, but I can quite easily see Kurt Russell talking to long-term collaborator and friend John Carpenter, can you put in a scene for my wife? And, you know, perfectly reasonable.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't detract from the film.
It's not as well integrated as one might like, but...
It is a little bit. I suppose it tells you it's a dangerous place, it adds something, but I agree. You could have cut it out without... losing a lot from the film.
And this is where I at least go briefly into Roger's guns corner. Because, again, they got the guns vaguely plausible. Probably they did this simply by renting them from a prop house and saying, give us some modern guns. It's not as if anybody's worried about magazine capacities or anything here. But there's a slight in-joke. Snake's main gun is a MAC-10. I admit I am biased, but I tend to think of it as the rubbish American copy of the Uzi.
Okay.
It's a bit heavier, it's a bit less capable, but it's American. But it's got all the accessories bolted onto it.
Is this like the Bling, the version of Bling that you would get with a Mac 10. Then.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little surprised there is no tactical bacon can on the slide, but, you know, it hasn't been invented yet. But certainly if one is at all serious about appreciating firearms used right, this is definitely a firearm, a poor, not terribly good, but suffering gun under all that garbage.
Anyway. But it looks cool. That's the important thing. So then he trudges back. Now, what happens next? He trudges back to the plane, I think, and he's met the cabbie. He realises Duke has probably got the president, and he's got to find a way to get to the Duke. And he finds out that the best way to do that is through his colleague, Brains, Harry Dean Stanton.
Mm-hmm. Well, he meets Adrienne Barbeau first.
Yes.
And then she gets him in to see Brains. Sorry, I should say. She does have a name. Maggie.
Maggie. And she's the female that has she's not a love interest, which is nice. She's just a competent. In fact, she's kind of her love is Brains. Who is, there's no love story there in the sense they're already together. Mm. It's nicely done. She's not there particularly for eye candy, though, you know, she is gorgeous, Adrienne Barbeau. It's just a nice character who could have been male in some ways, but is female, and it's just a strong female character, which is... it's about the best we're going to get in a film from the 80s, to be fair. But it's not an appalling disservice to women.
I mean, we're already doing better than the thing.
We're already doing better than the thing, and there is a female character there. Correct. So he meets up with Brains, who he knows from the past, who thought he was dead.
Brains is, incidentally, keeping the cars of Manhattan running via an oil well. You will be aware that there's obviously a lot of untapped oil under Manhattan.
Well, there was some mention earlier on that they said, we think they're running off, they've converted some cars to steam power. But I thought that was going to be great. We never see any sign of that. No, I thought they were going to be get some kind of clockwork punk kind of steampunk cars driving through. But no, they're just on gasoline. And apparently, yes, there is a well under Manhattan.
We do get some very blinged cars, to be fair.
One with double chandeliers.
I love it.
And it's that kind of crazy that I like. That kind of just. You know, it's off kilter, it's recognisably human, it's not quite, you know, full Mad Max leather thongs and things, but it's going to go in that direction in the next 20 or 30 years. I like it.
He has that sense of, you know, the world is a pile of rubbish, but I'm going to make my bit of it the way I damn well want to.
Yes, exactly. That's what I think that is perhaps my favourite part of this film, the character of it, the kind of, it's not just a grimy, dark... misery fest. It's got crazy character, and it feels a bit New York-y, and just a bit bonkers, and I love it. Brains has apparently got another MacGuffin, and the MacGuffin in this case is the map of the mines on the bridge over the Hudson River, maybe. I forget which river it is, but the bridge to get out.
One of the bridges. Did they blow up all the other bridges? Something like that. It would make
possibly. But he has a map, so he's the only one that can get over the bridge safely, and everyone else will die if they try. MacGuffin.
But also, this is what Duke's plan, the Duke, I apologise, his plan is not just to walk across the bridge, but to walk across the bridge with the president in front of them.
So
they can't simply be machine gunned by the police.
And to get everyone out of Manhattan, and to be quite well, they do then. I guess they'll think about it later. But yeah, Brains has been working on this in his spare time, presumably. But he agrees to help Snake, largely because Snake threatens to kill him if he doesn't.
Brains does, at least, yeah.
Yes, Snake is running out of time. He keeps glancing at his watch as it ticks down to like 15, 16 hours at this point. So they find out the president is being held in a train carriage in wherever train carriages are in New York.
And well, they have I think it's basically some sort of rail yard in the vague context of Grand Central.
So they sneak up. They don't sneak up there. The idea is Brains is going to distract the guards while Snake sneaks in the back and grabs the
prize. Unfortunately, it turns out that Brains' skill set is tech, not face.
Yes, exactly.
And the guards play along with him just enough to let him think he's getting away with it, and then make it clear that, no, I do not believe a word of this. Also, who's your sneaky friend?
Yes, Snake rescues the president, and then is almost instantly captured.
Yeah. And shot in the leg.
Is that when he gets shot in the leg?
Yeah.
Yes, it is. Yes, so now he can't walk very fast. He's also lost some... And this is the first time we see kind of daylight, because the whole film has been that night so far.
Mm.
But Snake wakes up some hours later, with not much time left, in the stronghold of the Duke.
Also has an appointment in the arena.
Yes, then we get the two men enter, one man leave wrestling match with the guy called Slug or Grog or Slap or Slag.
Slag.
Or Slag, there we go. We got there.
I can't remember who plays him, but the guy, yeah, a pro wrestler, which fair enough.
Hmm. I say good fight. I enjoyed this one. There was the one that took us out of it was the random wrestling scene with Rowdy Roddy Piper in They Live, which just I know one of our friends loves that scene greatly, but to us it felt a bit like this is the bit where Rowdy Roddy Piper shows off the fact that he is actually a wrestler. But here, it did feel necessary. There were that fight in They Live. There were no stakes to it, really. It didn't make any sense. But here, there are some big stakes.
I just wanted to put on these sunglasses for 5 seconds, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Here, there were some big stakes. Snake's got to get out. He's only got this long. The president's about to be marched across the bridge. I quite enjoyed this
fight. There's also a lot of theatricality in it. I mean, Slag obviously is doing his moves to look good as the champion. But also Snake, I may be reading too much into it, but you know, this is John Carpenter, I can't assume that. He's not only has he got to win, but he's got to win in a way that looks good so that the crowd who are cheering for Slag don't just swarm the ring and tear him apart.
And tear apart, yes, exactly, yeah. So we have sort of a bit of unarmed combat. Snake has been shot in the leg, badly. Again, it's a well-framed fight scene. We like fight scenes that kind of use the environment and the weapons and I mean, it's a wrestling ring, so.
Yeah, there's clearly some formality to it. They start with a particular set of weapons and then they change to a different set after the first round and so on.
You can see why people get into WWF. It's interesting. It's theatrical. It's silly, but it's dramatic. Anyway, Slug ends up with a plank with a nail on it through the back of his head, as I recall.
You will never regret a big stick with nails in it.
And Snake somehow then kind of... They're so excited about it that he just slips away.
I think, is the Duke managing his crowd.
Yes, yeah. But you'd think he would have been caught. Anyway, he realises that Brains has worked out, they don't call him Brains for nothing, where Snake possibly could have landed in New York, which must be on top of the World Trade Center. So Snake rushes there as quickly as he can to find Brains and Maggie about to get on the plane with the president in tow. Do they have the president at this point? I think they do.
They do. Does... I don't remember quite how it works. I wonder if it's Duke. No. Somebody's got the president, but I've lost
Maggie,
track of who it was.
Maggie and Brains have the president with them, okay. I think, and they're going to escape in the glider.
Which is interesting because it's very clearly a one-person glider.
Yes, exactly. I don't know what they're planning to do, but it doesn't matter.
Arguably, too, given that he was meant to get the president out, as opposed to just the president's wrist, but...
Maybe Maggie was going to find out to a cost quite what the plan was when they got to the glider. But it doesn't matter because the glider then gets pushed off the top of the World Trade Center by the zombie Murloc-alikes who live in New York but know how to get to the top of the World Trade Center. So they are forced to resort to another plan. And the other plan is running back down to the streets and panicking. And they are cornered by Duke and his men. But then good old Ernest Borgnine turns up, cabbie, and rescues them.
And
greatly regrets it later. Well, he doesn't get much time to regret it.
The basic plan I have remaining is I have got hold of the map at some point in the confusion, therefore we can just drive across the bridge.
Yes.
Presumably planning to wave a whole lot of white flags when they get to the point where they get shot.
Now, whether Brains is bluffing that he knows, I don't know, but his map doesn't seem to work very well.
Well, yeah. So, I mean... I, I suppose this was inevitable since the beginning of this podcast. Roger's tactical corner.
Yes.
You do not use mines to blow people up. You use mines to channel them into specific spaces as opposed to the overall space that they could be in, so right. that your other defences can take care of them. You make them go through this small gap where you've got all your machine guns
where
pointed.
You can ambush them. Okay. You don't use that as your sole means of defence.
Yeah. And, well, frankly, these are rather rubbish mines. Because we do see several of them blow up. One of them blows up and takes out the cab, fair enough.
And the cabbie, but everyone else in the car survives.
The rest, when they blow up, take out individuals, and not the people who are standing near them. So, this is no mine I've ever heard of.
They're not very powerful mines, are they? Brains, whether he's got the map upside down, I don't know, but he tells everyone he's going the right way and they're going wrong, and then he promptly stands on the mine and blows up.
Arguably, this is a point in favour of the Duke, because the obvious thing to do with this tactical situation would be to send your hordes of prisoners driven out in front of you.
Yes, yes.
You know, the 30-odd mines will kill 30-odd prisoners, and then the other 7,000 will swarm the wall.
I mean, I'm surprised they haven't done that already, because you could either make some kind of deal of, look, you either make it and you're free, or you spend the rest of your life in this shithole. Or you just say, do it or we'll beat you to death right now, and at least this way you've got a chance of making it. So I'm surprised they haven't tried this before already, but anyway, they haven't. Presumably because the machine guns at the other end will kill them. And maybe
that's the other thing, another tactical error. There are no machine guns at the other end. There is a wall.
Yeah. But, yeah, I was expecting some gun emplacements or something. But no, it's just a tall wall without even, like, barbed wire or anything on top of it. It's just a tall concrete wall. Anyway.
Well, okay, now, there is one thing we don't see, and this may partly account for it. I don't believe we ever see the way people go into the prison, though my suspicion is that it's basically a helicopter drop-off like the first team that goes in to try to get the president back.
Yeah, you get the impression...
Here is a helicopter with... 5 prisoners and 17 guards, and they will just shove you out when it's in the right place.
Yes. Yeah, you get the impression that the inmates are used to the odd helicopter arriving.
Yeah.
Again, I'm surprised they're not used to going in and ambushing, but then presumably they have a lot of armed guards that need you to get off and point guns at them. But then the Duke turns up, chandeliered to the nines, except... Does his car blow up? He has to get out of his car regardless because he can't get past the wreckage on the bridge.
Well, Maggie does a last stand because she's grieving over Brains.
Yeah, that felt a bit forced to me. But I like the fact that she's so in love with him that's it. And she is great as a heroic last stand. But
and
it felt a little
forced.
I find
myself resisting the urge to say that a certain line from The Princess Bride, you know, there's a shortage of perfect breasts in the world, it would be a shame to waste yours.
Exactly. Also, I don't know, there's not a ton of chemistry between Harry Dean Stanton and Adrienne Barbeau, so it didn't quite sell that match to me.
Though I think some of this is the whole environment is mad. And the scope for actual normal emotional connection is probably pretty darn limited.
Yep, fair enough. Fair enough. Anyway, the President and Snake get to the wall, but Duke turns up and is causing some trouble. Snake lets the President go first. He has got, like, I don't know, 2 minutes left before his head blows off. Mm-hmm. But he lets the President go first, regardless, presumably because it's going to go badly for him if he leaves the President behind and goes up the ladder himself. And then Duke turns up. There is a bit of a fight. And then a shot rings out, and it turns out to be none other than Donald Pleasance himself, who fired the fatal shot to kill Duke. It's a nice moment with a bloodthirsty president murdering a prison overlord, overdog. I can't get overdog out of my head. Snake rushes over the wall and very quickly gets his brains diffused or his carotid bombs turned off. And then we have the kind of punk denouement to the film, where the president is kind of semi-grateful, but he's got to go on TV now, and he's fine. And he doesn't sort of give Snake the respect that...
It's a real shame about all those guys who died trying to help, but got to go on TV now.
Yeah, yeah. He's not quite as happy as he should be. So Snake gives him the tape, the one sole surviving MacGuffin tape of fusion power, and then walks off into the darkness. And it turns out it's Cabby's favourite song instead. That was a nice bit of Donald Pleasant face acting when he realises. I mean, you can see it coming, but it's a nice bit. And then Snake destroys the tape, in Dirty Harry throwing his badge into the river fashion at the end. And that's it. That's Escape from New York. I mean, it's a solid action movie. And it's, you know, it's really well, paced. It's really, as we've said, it's well, I think I've become more sensitive to action and understanding what's going on. I enjoyed it in Children of Men, where we had some really good action sequences where you could follow it all. I mean, there's nothing quite like those set pieces here, but it is a solid action movie in a really interesting environment, in a setting that feels familiar to me, with a good soundtrack. It doesn't set the world on fire, but I really, really enjoyed it.
It does hold together. Each scene has got a thing saying, okay, we have resolved this bit of this problem, now we have this other problem, what can we do to try to resolve that? Okay, we need to do this, and then that leads to the next scene, and so on. Which, all right, it doesn't seem as if it should be a high bar, but I do see films, we have talked about films in which that doesn't quite hold together.
Yes, exactly.
I suspect that, as in other Carpenter films, some of the ideas for a particular scene in a particular place may have come first, but he has done the work, he and Nick Castle have done the work to stitch that together.
Yeah, it's a faintly kind of ridiculous concept, but, you know, there's a brand of science fiction that is this kind of stupid but take it very seriously. It does it well. I prefer
it's a ridiculous concept, but also they don't dawdle over the setup.
Exactly, yeah. I felt like they tripped over that a bit.
Now, here is the action.
As far as an action film goes, I feel like it does everything you want for an action film. It's not quite Die Hard levels for me, because Die Hard's just got a kind of a joy to it as well, and some twists and turns. But this, I don't know, what you want from an action film is this, I feel. I really, really enjoyed it.
And while Snake is clearly a tough guy, he's not playing for the muscles the way Schwarzenegger, to some extent, Stallone would do.
So. Yeah, the later sort of 80s action heroes became all about the kind of physicality and the, which is why, you know, that's why Die Hard comes to mind, actually. Snake is a bit more like a John McClane character, obviously vulnerable, not ridiculously over the top, like John McClane was. And you forget the reason John McClane felt, or Bruce Willis felt like a breath of fresh air, is because from here we had all these ridiculous tough guys that were more or less invulnerable for about 10 years until Die Hard came along. And that was refreshing at first, but had got pretty tired by the time of Die Hard.
So just looking at our films we've previously talked about, this comes out the same year as Mad Max 2.
I was going to ask, because there is a Mad Max 2... slightly ridiculousness to it. I mean, it's much more dialed back because, again, it's earlier in the bonkers. But I don't think there's any copying going on there, but it was probably just something in the air. I think it was just probably Mad Max the original influenced this film a bit, yeah. I would have thought. Yeah. This film, as far as was this film influential, definitely in my corner of the world. That's all I can say.
Yeah. I think one of the reasons it seemed so familiar as I was watching it was, as we talked about before, we've seen these tropes done in later films.
Yes.
Often with a higher budget, but it really worked for me.
Yeah, absolutely. So influential
we also have
on...
one acknowledged influence, or at least semi-acknowledged influence, because in 1984, William Gibson publishes Neuromancer, and one of the things he specifically said was in one of the opening scenes, the warden just says as a passing line to say, you know, this is why we want you to go in on the glider.
Oh, we talked about Leningrad.
You flew the
we?
Gulfire over Leningrad, didn't you?
Yes. And that's it.
There's no explanation of what that is, though presumably this glider is also a Gulfire. But it gives you the sense of a larger world, and Gibson explicitly acknowledged that. And indeed, he had as a background incident in Neuromancer. Of course, Neuromancer also has the there is a bomb in you, and it will mess you up if you don't do what we want. So
yes, yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought again that world building of just nodding again, like the whole kind of I thought you were dead snake. It's never explained, but it because there is a world out there, but we're in this compressor. I like it. It's great world building. How does it compare to other Carpenter films that we've seen? I mean, for me, I preferred it to They Live. I don't think much is going to top The Thing for me. I much preferred it to Halloween. I was not a fan of Halloween. I think it's right
up there.
The
Thing will be next year relative to this.
Yeah, The Thing will always be.
And The Fog was the year before.
Oh, I like The Fog. I think Assault from Precinct 13. I think this is... Ooh, it's on a par, if not better than that, for me.
It feels like an answer to that in some ways. I mean, it is the next one in Carpenter's sequence that is an action film rather than a horror film or something else.
Yeah, yeah. And it works really well. It may be my second favourite Carpenter, though I may be forgetting some. Certainly of the ones we've watched. Ghosts of Mars is the next sort of slightly ridiculous action movie. We like that, but this is better. I mean,
Grant, yeah.
That was originally. Am I misremembering? Ghosts of Mars was originally going to be a Snake Plissken film. It was going to be like Escape from Mars or something like that.
I wonder. But I wouldn't be
imagining
surprised.
Yeah, it has a similar feel.
We should perhaps mention that there is a sequel, Escape from LA. Snake Plissken returns.
Yeah, we've been recommended not to watch it. Yeah. I probably will watch it, but. If we watch it and we both like it, maybe we'll talk about it for the film. I'm not sure I'm comfortable eviscerating a John Carpenter film. I did with Halloween, I have to say. Halloween was not for me. We'll probably give it a try and maybe we'll mention it at some point.
But, I will call this masterpiece A, because I enjoyed it a lot, but also B, because of these influences that are very obvious.
I think I think it is. I may be influenced by my own circle of kind of people that I tend to meet with. I think it's super influential. I think there are better action films, but there's a lot worse action films. I think for me it does sneak into masterpiece. It's not perfect. Oh, yeah. Well, in a ways it is perfect in what it does, and that's. But I guess some masterpiece films are brilliant what they do, and then they add a bit more. And I'm not sure this has quite got the bit. Maybe the kind of the bling and the chandeliers on the.
There's some little bits here and there where you think, you know, maybe if they'd had more time to expand it in, more budget to expand it with, there could have been more here, but there isn't. So
I shouldn't criticize it for not being the film that it is. I think it is a masterpiece, but I'm slightly hesitant, but I agree. I think it is. Good job, John Carpenter. More, please. Except he's retired now, never mind. We've got plenty more of his to do.
He's retired several times, I believe.
I think he means it this time.
Negative reactions to various films that later go on to become hugely popular.
I will say, the reason he has become probably the favourite of this podcast is just he's so versatile in that he's a polymath in that, you know, he has all the, you know, he's a director, a writer, a composer. He did films like this, In the Mouth of Madness, The Thing, Starman. They're not huge. Well, I don't know, Starman I'd like to show. I don't know if you'd like it, but I like it. It's a very emotional movement. But he's just so versatile. So Spielberg, I mean, we talked about Spielberg a lot, but Spielberg is greatly appreciated as a director, and I'm not sure Carpenter is in the way that he should be.
This probably makes me give up my film critic card, only just having just realised I've got one, but there are Spielberg films that leave me bored.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I have not been bored in a John Carpenter film yet.
No, I've been angry in Halloween. But, yeah, that's true. It's always well-paced. There were parts of They Live that dragged a bit for me, if I'm honest. But I'm not here to take John Carpenter down because he's great. All right, well, I'm sure we'll return to his oeuvre. In fact, we definitely will. But for now, that's it for this episode.
He doesn't have a catchphrase. He ought to have a catchphrase to be a proper 80s action hero, but he doesn't have one.
Goodbye.